Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is September the 25th, 2019. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message if you have any questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. In the headlines, Remembrance of Saul Libus, the passing of a PC pioneer. Amazon changes algorithm to promote more profitable products. Court rules Amazon may be liable for third-party products. Apple is launching a research app that will allow U.S. consumers to participate in health studies. AMD has been beating Intel in processors sold. Feature segments this evening: IT Pro Series by Benjamin Rockwell, LinkedIn usage guidance. From the Tech Corner, American deserves greater transparency from big tech. In big tech, we trust. How much power does big tech really have? Facebook's customer satisfaction scores plunging. We have technology perspectives from Marty Winston. Shiny new gizmos will mean that resistance is futile. I met Saul Libus 43 years ago, and we became very good friends. He is among one of the early pioneers in personal computing. Saul Libus passed away last Saturday, September the 21st. He was in declining health for several years due to prostate cancer, arthritis, and a series of strokes. He was 89. Saul grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and attended Lincoln High School, where he met his wife-to-be, Elaine Kalish, whom we call Lenny. He attended Brooklyn College as an economics major, and he was drafted during the Korean War. With Lenny, Saul served part of the war in France and Germany. He taught electronics for 25 years at Union County Technical Institute, now Union County College. He became a full professor and served as department chair for several years. But Saul was more interested in technology and education than administration. During that time, he began writing the book Repairing Transistor Radios, the first book on the subject. Saul went on to write 15 more books on topics from TV repair to digital logic and microcomputer hardware. While at UCC, Saul became interested in digital electronics and began experimenting with early consumer computers. He built his first computer using an Intel 8008 CPU with 1024 bytes of memory. Determined to share his interests, he founded the Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, that's the ACGNJ, where he served as president. ACGNJ had 1,600 members and published a monthly 24-page newsletter. Along with Al Katz, Saul co-founded the Trenton Computer Festival, the oldest and longest-running personal computer show. Both ACGNJ and TCF continue to this day. Saul was a member of the Professional Association Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, that's called the IEEE, and served on their standards bodies related to interfacing issues, including the S100 bus, and went on to write a book about it. Saul and Lenny created their own magazine, Microsystems, and later another called Microsystems Journal. At their peak, the two magazines had a circulation of 60,000. After retirement, Saul and Lenny moved to Virginia, spent time in South Carolina, and eventually they came back to New Jersey, where they settled down in Princeton, New Jersey, where Saul taught computer classes to seniors at the Computer Learning Center at Ewing. Saul is survived by his loving wife of 66 years, Lenny, daughter Susan, son Don, and a granddaughter, Kenna. He'll be missed. Amazon changes algorithm to promote more profitable products, so reported the Wall Street Journal. It wasn't too long ago that we reported on the government's investigation into Amazon's misuse of the Amazon Choice badge. And now the e-commerce giant has been called out by the Wall Street Journal for changing its algorithm yet again. According to several sources that worked on the secret algorithm, Amazon has been promoting products with greater profit margins for the last year or so instead of displaying products based on users' search terms. Despite internal opposition, Amazon's Seattle-based retail team pressured the Palo Alto, California-based search team, referred to as A9 Engineers, to boost Amazon-made products and other private label brands that rank high in contribution profit. According to the Wall Street Journal, contribution profit is considered a better measure of a product's profitability because it factors in non-fixed expenses such as shipping and advertising, leaving the amount left over to cover Amazon's fixed costs. As expected, Amazon is denying the allegations and was quick to respond with a tweet after the news broke. They released the following statement. The Wall Street Journal has it wrong. We explain at length that their scoop from unnamed sources was not factually accurate. But they went ahead with the story anyway. The fact is, we have not changed the criteria we use to rank search results profitability. We feature the products customers will want, regardless of whether they are our own brands or products offered by our selling partners. As any store would do, we consider the profitability of the products we list and feature on the site, but it is just one metric and not in any way a key driver of what we show customers. Ironically enough, Amazon is already facing a few antitrust probes, already including one alongside Google, Facebook, and Apple. House lawmakers requested that the tech giants release their personal communications to figure out if there's any evidence of anti-competitive behavior. Then there is the European Union antitrust probe over the treatment of third-party merchants and a letter that needs answering by CEO Jeff Bezos as to whether Amazon's choice button also favors Amazon's own products. A U.S. appeals court ruled that Amazon may be held liable for third-party products sold on its platform. The decision came from the 3rd U.S. City Court of Appeals in Philadelphia and reverses the lower court ruling that had previously come out in Amazon's favor. The ruling states, Amazon fails to account for the fact that under the agreement, third-party vendors can communicate with the customers only through Amazon. This enables third-party vendors to conceal themselves from the customer, leaving customers injured by defective products with no direct recourse to the third-party vendor. If upheld, the ruling could completely change the way Amazon handles business. After all, third-party sellers are responsible for 58% of Amazon's total sales, bringing in $11 billion in revenues during the previous quarter. But Amazon's hands-off approach has ultimately enabled counterfeit and dangerous items to slip through the cracks and be sold to consumers. Last year, a Tennessee family lost their home to an exploding hoverboard that they purchased from a third-party seller who neglected to disclose the product's dangers. The one that got Amazon in the most trouble, though, was Heather Oberdorf's dog leash, purchased from marketplace seller, the Furry Gang, that snapped, leaving her permanently blind in one eye. After a district court found that Amazon couldn't be sued over the leash, Oberdorf appealed the ruling, and the court largely found in her favor. It's gratifying that the Third Circuit Court agreed with our argument and recognized the existing interpretation of product liability law in Pennsylvania and was not addressing the reality, the dominance that Amazon has in the marketplace, Oberdorf's lawyer told Reuters. Amazon has not yet spoken on the matter, but it's likely that they will appeal the ruling. Meanwhile, neither Oberdorf nor Amazon have been able to contact the furry group, but the lower court will determine whether or not the leash was indeed defective. Apple is launching a research app that will allow U.S. consumers to participate in health studies. Translation. Apple wants people to volunteer to give them your personal medical data. Did I read that right? Earlier in April of this year, we reported that Facebook was secretly working on gathering patient data from hospitals. Some of the hospitals have since withdrawn from providing Facebook any data. Facebook had initially focused its research on cardiovascular health. None of the statements from Facebook to date sound as if it is putting an end to this program. Perhaps Apple have learned a lesson from this. They are being open about a new project. Apple is launching a research app that will allow U.S. consumers to participate in health studies. Apple is launching a new research app for Apple Watch owners that will allow people to opt to privately contribute to health research by sharing the data collected from the smartwatch and its many sensors, as well as the Apple Health app. The news of the app was announced at iPhone press event alongside a trio of new health studies and the next generation Apple Watch Series 5. As an example of the sort of data users could contribute through the Apple Watch, the company detailed a few new studies with partners like the University of Michigan, the World Health Organization, Harvard School of Public Health, the NIH, the American Heart Association, and the Brigham and Women's Hospital. The topics to be studied include the long-term effects of sounds on your hearing health, how menstrual cycles can inform the screenings for infertility and osteoporosis, and how activity and movement impacts overall health. All this is very personal data. Before people who wanted to opt into health studies through Apple's partnership, they would have to install a specialized app on their iOS device dedicated to that study alone. The new research app will instead allow for a single portal for this sort of opt-in activity. Apple also promised to respect users' data privacy, saying that you decide what data you want to share with the studies, and that Apple cannot access any information that directly identifies you. We hope. The research app will launch in the United States later this year. I commend Apple for its open approach, but we still remind everyone that it is your personal data that's being used to create the data information product to be used by Apple. Big tech companies collect personal data, and it is monetized in some form for the business profit of that corporation. Think twice before you volunteer for this. Microsoft confirms that new updates for Windows 10 will be a little different. Windows 10 has had a quality control problem, and Microsoft has made improvements how updates will be handled in Windows 10. Windows 10 will soon warn users which updates they do and do not need to install. Microsoft has confirmed it is changing the Windows 10 update experience, so users will now be warned which updates they do not need to install. Given that in the last month alone, the aforementioned problems along with screen discoloration and spiking CPU usage were all caused by updates users didn't need to install. This should make a big difference not just to Windows 10 stability, but users' peace of mind overall. It should also be familiar to Windows 7 users that this is exactly how Windows 7 operates. Microsoft sorted updates into important and optional categories so users could better judge what they wanted to be installed on their computers. The fact that this was scrapped in Windows 10 in favor of lumping all updates together and that it has subsequently taken Microsoft 4 years to bring it back is, well, I don't know why it took so long. Windows 7 always had updates split into important and optional categories. Windows 10 is now catching up. That said, Windows 10 users still won't have quite the same level of control over their updates as Windows 7. This is because Windows 7 frequently clashed drivers, net framework, quality updates, and more as optional, while drivers, a frequent source of problems, will still be updated automatically in Windows 10 by default. Beware of complacency. AMD is beating Intel right now. What a surprise! AMD Ryzen 3000 is killing it in sales. AMD is experiencing a surge in both popularity and sales, but we've just seen some analysis that really puts AMD's recent victories into perspective. Both the AMD Ryzen 7 3700X and AMD Ryzen 5 3600 have outsold Intel's entire product range, and this isn't exactly a new occurrence. That alone would be enough to assert AMD's dominance. Ingeborg gathered up a whole bunch of sales data from Mindfactory that illustrates just how far AMD has come in the last decade. According to this data, AMD has been beating Intel in the amount of processors sold since the tail end of 2018. But that didn't exactly translate into AMD collecting more cash. This is probably because Intel charges much more for its processors on average. Ingeborg included a graph recording the average selling price for each processor, and Intel has been much higher for years now, so even if AMD sells more processors, that doesn't result in more revenue. According to the revenue graph, AMD has recently experienced a massive spike in revenue and in the average selling price of its processors. It looks like this spike occurred right around when AMD launched its Ryzen 3rd generation lineup, spearheaded by the Ryzen 9 3900X. From the way things are looking now, it doesn't look like Intel will be taking back its leadership role in the desktop CPU market anytime soon, at least until Team Blue puts out its 10th generation desktop lineup. We've seen some rumors that it would be putting out some 10th generation Cascade Lake X processors, but it's unlikely the HEDT chips like that will regain Intel's market dominance. Why is AMD doing so well? AMD launched its first generation of Ryzen processors in early 2017. And that's right when we see the first spike of that red line on all three graphs. Before that, AMD had relied on its struggling Bulldozer CPU architecture, which allowed Intel to dominate the desktop CPU market with little to no competition. AMD Ryzen could have easily been a fluke, but Intel kept releasing more and more optimization of Skylake rather than innovating, which helped AMD's Zen architecture take over. With each AMD Ryzen release, we see AMD gaining market share, with another spike in 2018 with Ryzen's second generation, and then an absolutely big rise this year with AMD Ryzen 3rd generation. Intel will be putting out a new Coffee Lake refresh chip with the Intel Core i9-9900KS. And while it will probably sell, it is a 5 GHz on all cores, meaning it will be a speedy little piece of silicon. But will it be enough to reverse the trend? However, if Intel is able to bring some of the efficiency and AI features in Ice Lake to the desktop audience without significantly raising the price of its silicon, we might see Team Blue start to claw its way back to dominance. Competition brings out advances. It's nice to see AMD give Intel some long-awaited competition. But the last thing we want to see is AMD fall into complacency like Intel did. When the PC component marketplace is competitive, everyone wins. So we want nothing more than for Intel to put out some killer processors. Now all we have to do is sit and wait to see what the 10th generation has in store. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. He will be talking about LinkedIn usage guidance.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and it's time to get down to business. Yes, this is where I give you some benefit from my experience of being an IT professional for many years. Recently, we were talking about LinkedIn, and we were talking about the importance of LinkedIn, but I wanted to give you some guidance in regards to LinkedIn a little bit more beyond just the matter of if you should be on LinkedIn. We've established you need to be there, but we need to also establish that there are things that you need to follow, certain directions, certain guidance for utilizing LinkedIn for your best personal, professional purposes. First off, do not confuse LinkedIn with any of the other social media sites out there. Don't confuse it with Instagram or Snapchat or Facebook. It's so easy for us to go on out and say, okay, it's just social media. We'll just post whatever we want. Now, this isn't the water cooler area at the office. This is something that you are going to be sharing, whatever you share, with your current boss, a future boss, your current coworkers. It needs to be professional. It needs to be something that will help yourself, or maybe did help yourself, or will help other people. Okay, so if you're in the IT field, you might post IT-related items, especially professional IT-related items. You want to post content and advice and opinions that are professional-based. Now, another thing that I see going wrong all the time on LinkedIn is people will take pictures of themselves with their spouse or their former girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever it is. You know, it's all kinds of different things, and then they just snip that person out. No, that's not the right thing. This is not the place where you put in your animals, your favorite car, your hobby, your vacation. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. What you want to do is you want the professional you. You want a picture of yourself as if you're going to the office. No, better yet, you're going to a professional event. You're representing your company. So what does that mean? Well, for guys, yeah, that's suit and tie. A sport coat and tie, that works too. And a nice dress shirt. Ladies, similar attire. Again, business attire. So you want, you know, not business casual. You want business formal attire. Now, we did establish that there is a reason for LinkedIn, but you've got to make sure that you're following that purpose, that you are utilizing it for your best efforts. One of those things I talked about, your own professional branding. Again, I mentioned back then, I go by Benjamin Rockwell. You're going to utilize whatever kind of name, whatever kind of different interests you have that will further your career. Now, it's also a place for you to get business information, for you to leverage the knowledge of others, the experience of others to better your career overall. Now, employers, future employers, and recruiters and other job advantages are best found on LinkedIn versus any of the other sites out there. So remember that. You're going to leverage all of this to your best effort. Now, you also need to make sure that your profile establishes, it's like a super resume. It establishes a lot of the key features from your past. It puts you out there with the best wording that you can for each of the different projects that you worked on. You know, we go out and we do these different projects, and we only highlight some of the ones that are really key for obtaining the new job. Well, in this case, you're not always going to be focused on, yes, I worked with this particular type of widget. No, you need to tell people that you dealt with all kinds of different widgets. So you lay all kinds of different things out so people can see a better idea of who you are. Now, you're going to do this not so much in resume format, but in kind of that action style, I accomplished this. This is how powerful I was with that and things like that. And we get into a lot of different things which are best left to the resume writers. I'm talking the professional resume writers. And it wouldn't hurt to actually reach out to one of them to leverage all of your past information into the best LinkedIn profile that you can develop for yourself. Now, you can't have any mismatches. You can't have any different things in there that are, well, you're not going to lie, because yes, your former employer is going to be there. Your former boss will see your profile. So you want to tell the truth. But that's a good thing we should be doing all the time anyway, right? Now, you also want to make sure that you are following up on all of the messages, all of the friend requests that you get. And yes, you're going to get some odd ones, and you can ignore the odd ones, But yeah, you want to connect with people. I will tell you that there is a nice little guideline that was given to me. You need to initially start off within the first little bit. You need an effort where you're going to find 500 connections. I know that's a lot, but you've probably worked with a lot of people over the years. You want to deal with people who know you on a professional basis. Now, some of that professional basis can be like volunteer work. All right, it doesn't have to be paid work. I have a lot of people that I connect with at my church. And why do I do that? Because they've seen me professionally doing work there. They've seen me doing all kinds of different volunteer work. So they can speak to me as far as my background and what I am capable of doing, what I know how to do, and how I react and behave. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. After each revelation of privacy invasion by a big tech company, both Democrats and Republicans demand reform and accountability. Yet, so far, this has had little impact in new legislation to prevent this. Americans continue to wait for Washington to address the issue of tech giants' routine misuse and weaponization of our data. Who is big tech? It's Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. One can't help but wonder if our representatives have come to grips with a future where their constituents' everyday life is dominated by a small handful of privacy-invading corporations. Polling shows it's a huge concern for voters, with 91% of Americans believing that people have lost control over the use of personal data by businesses, and two-thirds of Americans demanding policymakers to do more to protect our privacy. What is touching most Americans is that companies like Amazon and Google are persuading millions of Americans to put surveillance devices into their homes, devices like Echo and Home Assistant that are capable of recording and eavesdropping on kinds of communications that we have. Recent reports show this is not a mere paranoia. Microsoft, not usually associated with the privacy violations of Google and Amazon, listened into conversations occurring on its video game platform, Xbox, and in some cases recorded these interactions. The intrusions was carried out by contractors and oftentimes involved listening to and recording children. Human contractors were also listening to Skype calls and audio recorded by Cortana, Microsoft's virtual assistant. It's still unclear who these outside contractors are exactly and whether there is any vetting process to ensure that the freelancers listening to Americans don't have criminal records. Microsoft is hardly the only culprit, though. The practice of snooping and recording us in our homes takes place at Amazon, Google, and Apple, too. Bloomberg reported that Apple will stop storing audio recordings from Siri interactions and will no longer use outside contractors to review the recordings, of course, after they were caught doing it. For Microsoft, though, it appears to be business as usual. The company simply tweaked its terms of service to disclose that outside contractors will continue to listen in on our online conversations. All of which raises an important question. As Congress wrestles with policies to limit tech monopolies' privacy invasion, should issues like home surveillance, snooping on minors, and worker background checks be part of that discussion? And isn't it time to demand legislation and legal recourse rather than big tech's empty promise of industry's self-regulation? It's time for Congress to require tech companies to submit to a handful of reasonable requirements regarding its listening habits on our private conversations. Any company that listens to or records consumers, either through in-home assistance, apps, or gaming consoles, should post clear information regarding its practice and exactly who is doing the collecting. This should be more akin to front-of-package labeling than fine print, and should be clear on the use of contractors. We should know what entities, employees, or contractors work for, and what background checks takes place before they can listen to us and our children in our homes. Lawmakers should convene a hearing to understand how tech companies differentiate between children and adults. Like past efforts to govern advertising, tech companies must not be allowed to monitor, target, or sell, or generally take advantage of children through deceptive tactics. If they have improperly taken data from children, the Federal Trade Commission must take strong action for violations of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. Congress should continue its comprehensive work on privacy legislation, modernizing outdated laws to recognize the convergence of technology. America needs a platform-neutral policy that does not pick winners and losers based on traditional definition of internet providers versus edge providers versus e-commerce companies. These industries are all trafficking data for profit and all run the risk of abusing Americans' data rights. They should be treated equally as a result. It's time for action. In Big Tech We Trust, how much power does Big Tech really have? That's the overriding question. There are conservative allegations that Google searches are biased. Are the biggest tech companies monopolies? Is Facebook acting like a little country by starting their own currency? What is Facebook's stated reason for starting a currency? Facebook plans to create its own money called the Libra, and the stated goal is to bank the unbanked. An estimated 1.7 billion people on Earth do not have a bank account. Many of them are Facebook users. So there is an altruistic spin here. Facebook is going to create its own currency to help them, but thereby taking on the key power of nation states, the power to mint money. That sounds really great, being innovative and giving people the power of currency. Although, of course, it also gives a certain amount of power to Facebook, which gets to monitor those transactions, monetize those transactions, and who knows what. It definitely raises a lot of concerns. For example, about, you know, what do you do about money laundering? How will the company and its partners protect privacy? What happens to the interest earned on the Libra deposits? Regulators are striking a very different tone here as well. France's foreign minister came out saying this can't and it must not happen. Facebook and its partners shouldn't have a sovereign currency. The UK minister says his country is willing to engage with Facebook, and US Treasury Secretary made it clear at a briefing that he's not comfortable with Facebook launching its currency. Facebook won't launch Libra until they have fully addressed regulatory concerns and receive appropriate approvals. That's a real departure from how most powerful tech companies have been approaching governments these last few years. You'll recall Uber, who, for example, went into cities, opened up shop, hid from regulators who wanted to stop them, and Facebook and Google have been criticized for avoiding responsibility in Europe for the hate speech that's going viral on their platform. But finance, it's a very regulated, heavy industry, and Facebook has to be more open about it. Facebook is also aware that they, along with other big tech companies, are being suspected of becoming monopolies. Members of Congress want to drill into how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple each works, how they each deal with their competitors and collaborators. These companies have differences. For example, Amazon and Google both sell advertising, but Amazon's ad money is basically a fee to vendors for them to show up in Amazon search pages. Google is not that, but it is in the company's interest to close rank, to not throw each other under the bus, and to make the conversation just go away. Beware of big tech. You're not the only person who's feeling grumpy about Facebook. A new survey shows customer satisfaction with the social network plunging to a level that almost makes cable TV look good. The latest findings from the American Customer Satisfaction Index, that's the ACSI, show that the popular mood has flipped against Facebook to a degree really seen in the Ann Arbor, Michigan ACSI's annual survey. ACSI results shows a dramatic loss in user satisfaction with Facebook, and the site plummeted 6% to the industry bottom with an ACSI score of 63. The study reports that 63 out of 100, a D grade that only stands a point above the 62 score the pay TV industry notch in the ACSI latest assessment. In contrast, while people love to complain about airlines, that industry has an ACSI score of 74. Facebook would be foolish to see this score as anything other than angry face emojis. The bad news has piled up. The ACSI study cites Facebook privacy as the top complaint, saying customer satisfaction with that hit an all-time low and is now trailing all other social media sites by a wide gap. How wide remains unclear. ACSI managing director said in an email sent by a publicist that the survey doesn't release those data subsets to the public. Whatever the number, you can't blame Facebook users for fretting about how much the firm knows about them, to the degree that people will believe the unsupported and improbable charge that its mobile apps listen to them, well, surreptitiously. The Cambridge Analytica scandal saw the information of tens of millions of users scooped up by a third-party app and is now the subject of the Netflix documentary, The Great Hack. As a result, the Federal Trade Commission hit Facebook with a $5 billion fine to punish it for that and other failings. But to Facebook, $5 billion was chump change. They should have fined them for 1 year's profit. But the small size of that penalty next to Facebook's $16.9 billion in the second quarter revenue only fuels the feeling that the company can continue to avoid accountability and pursue such grandiose goals as introducing a worldwide cryptocurrency called Libra. The ACSI further saw customers rank Facebook below rivals in the intrusiveness of the ads, the difficulty of uploading photos and video, and the overall quality of its newsfeed. That last item is also easy to understand, considering Facebook struggles with fake personnel accounts, fake public pages, and fake or doctored videos. But we're okay with Instagram. And yet ACSI respondents, almost 8,000 people in the study, randomly selected from a pool of some 300,000 and interviewed via email between July 17, 2018 and June 26 of this year, unchanged from last year. This despite the fact that the photo sharing service is owned by the company they don't trust to protect their privacy. ACSI said that reflects the survey focus on app experience. ACSI's benchmark data reflects users' impressions of the responsiveness of the app if the ads are intrusive and how easy the app is to navigate. That Facebook owns Instagram likely isn't factored into user assessments, and therefore the tie isn't extensively captured in ACSI data, if at all. It is true that many Instagram users treat it as a separate network, combined with such a high ACSI score that suggests Insta would be a powerful competitor to Facebook. But the FTC punted and forcing Facebook to undo its 2012 purchase of that firm. ACSI users were happiest with Pinterest, which was unchanged from last year's survey at 80. YouTube ranked second at 78, up from 75, despite that Google's service continued flailing in the face of extreme content and abusive behavior. Things you can do about Facebook. Will these feelings put a meaningful dent in Facebook? Facebook-owned numbers shows a slight increase in daily average users in the United States and Canada to 187 million users, but that's not the whole story. The research from eMarketer's numbers suggests that we're going on a bit of a Facebook detox, with average daily time spent dropping from 41 minutes in 2017 to 38 minutes in 2018. Changing the settings in Facebook app to bug you less often can help with that. To hit Facebook harder, switch to a desktop web browser that stops Facebook tracking of you across the sites. The key to its booming ad business, and the real reason why those ads can seem frighteningly well-informed. Apple's Safari browser has done that since 2018, and Mozilla Firefox added the same default protection last month. And whenever Facebook finally ships the clear history option to wipe its data about your web habits, first announced last May, but still unavailable, you should use that immediately. Meanwhile, the ACSI's own history suggests that Facebook has yet to hit bottom, Its lowest score ever, 61, came in 2012, the year after its previous FTC settlement. Another year of headlines like the last 12 months? Worth could easily send Facebook's score lower. Do you know what Facebook is doing with your personal data? Presenting Technology Perspectives with Marty Winston, where he talks about the black and green of the season. It may not even be winter yet where you live, but at retailers and e-tailers everywhere, it's the beginning of their busiest selling season of the year. Marty warns that for many people, the collection of shiny new gizmos will mean that your resistance will be futile.
When it's not summer anymore, once the kids are back in school, once football season starts, once we're past the autumnal equinox, once the primetime TV season launches, well, there's something just a little bit different in the air. And for that matter, on the air. In tech, if you're a company making products, what's in the air is something between hope and panic. And if you're a store selling products, whether brick and mortar or online, it's also a time of hope and panic. But if you're a consumer, oh boy, it's a time when you're exposed to more temptations than ever, when all the shiny, seductive allure of advertising and promotions are all targeting whatever money you can muster. Well, let me set the stage for what's behind it all. And just maybe, by the time we're done, you'll surrender a little less control to the forces trying to charm and sweet-talk you into a February with no money to leave the cabin fever. If I were to tell you it's all about the December holidays, I'd be a little right and a little wrong. I'd also be a little right and a little wrong if I were to say it's all about the fourth calendar quarter, but those are good starting points. You see, there's a more approximate, more de facto fourth quarter that starts just before the end of September, and it continues until just before the end of January. It's about 4 to 5 weeks longer than the calendar fourth quarter. This is when more than half of all consumer product purchases for the year get made. It's also when a big chunk of business purchasing happens, spending out old year budgets and buying from approved new year budgets. Okay, you've seen stores get a jump on every other holiday. Easter candy appears the day after Valentine's Day candy leaves the shelves. Halloween products have already been on the shelves for weeks. And the shift to Christmas, that's also underway. A head start of 3 full months. You've also seen stores do a lot of shifting around of what products are on which shelves, where in the store. In retail jargon, that's called a reset. There's even a name for the map of where products go per shelf and per aisle. That's called a planogram. The planograms that your favorite stores just put into effect have been in the works since April. The major store reset that just happened is their biggest, most significant one of the whole year. Here's why. If consumers coming into the store, going through the store, and eventually checking out of the store don't find appealing new things, the store is in grave danger of losing money. And you know how many major stores have gone out of business in recent years. It's also a stressful time for the companies behind those products on the shelves. Their current and future successes absolutely depend on whether or not enough of their products get pulled from those shelves and dropped into shopping carts. If strong sell-through doesn't happen, the company may suffer and in some cases go out of business. So there's a lot at stake. Black ink, being profitable, being in the black, entirely depends on their ability to attract shoppers' green money. That's the black and green of the season. That's the hope. That's the panic. Now, what's that got to do with you? Let's start with about a year ago, when the companies making products started looking at what they wanted to have available to buy now. Many of them would look for gimmicks added features may or may not be truly useful, but that may get some customers to impulse buy. That's how toasters grew to have wider slots for bagels and special modes for frozen waffles. Now, for even remotely tech products, sometimes the gimmicks are in the specs. Do you need the first smartphone with six separate 10-gigapixel cameras? Hey, if that just sounded appealing, then right now, pull over if you have to, but right this minute, hand your credit cards over to your spouse for safekeeping. Pay attention to this. There's shopping and there's impulse buying, and they're not the same thing. Shopping is when you go to buy things that you need based on evaluations you made before going to the store. Impulse buying is when you see something and immediately decide you want it. Never mind that you don't need it. Never mind that you already have better ways to do whatever it is that the thing you just happen to run into says it does. Control those cravings. But wait, am I saying that you should control those cravings? Or am I saying that the sellers and stores are out to control your cravings? Both. Yes, both. Creating cravings, creating the want, is a very deliberate tactical approach for sellers to hedge their bets. You can see it happening, but you may or may not notice it. At this point, it may seem, more like a seasonal thing than an assault on your emotions. When you're on Facebook, think about the number of posts from your friends and think about the number of ads on your feed. The ratio just shifted. More ads are in the balance. Do you still read newspapers? There are more ad pages right now and more inserted ad sections. There are more ads and ad mailers and promotional mail in your postal mailbox and in your email. And the climb has only just begun. They're out to snag you. Now is also when new campaigns break. The more compelling coupons, the more interesting, often more misleading commercials. And if, like me, you're in the press, this is also the time of year when there's a storm surge of press releases. The good news is, if you're careful and reasonable, and who is, really, but the good news is that if you're careful and reasonable, the year's most interesting and innovative new products are getting introduced now. Limit yourself. Just limit yourself. Sure, there are some cool things you want to buy to use and to buy as useful gifts. Always keep in mind that purchasing is a behavior, and once people are induced to exhibit that behavior, they tend to continue purchasing. It feels good. Buying stuff feels good, doesn't it? Do you remember that I said that this buying surge continues for almost a month past Christmas? Here's why. Everybody's credit card bills for the most intensive round of buying of the year will arrive between the 20th and 25th of January. People see those bills. They get shocked by how much they spent. They vow never to spend another unnecessary dollar ever again. And for the most part, people keep that promise, making for major sales slumps in February and early March. Because people do hold true to that pledge, they keep that promise until their income tax refunds arrive and they feel free to do more spending and buying again. Oh, well. But for right now, just keep in mind that not every new product you encounter will be wonderful. Some will. I mean, there will be some that are, but their evil counterparts are more marginally beneficial or sometimes unnecessary trinkets or novelties or bling or hype-frosted products that really don't earn their keep. You don't have to ignore new products. Just try to look for products that address specific needs in superior ways. Ask yourself if they're so much better at addressing those needs that they merit the cost of replacing whatever it is you use now to do the same thing. And make it a practice never, never to buy a product the same day you first see it. Truly useful, truly beneficial, truly advantageous products are rare. New products are not, great products are. Metaphorically, this is the year's peak hunting season for those rare prizes, but thanks to all the hype, the field is littered with decoys. Next time, I'll focus on new rules for power tools. The tech has been ratcheting up, and I can help flag some of the differences that's making in batteries and motors and features and life expectancy and more. be here and give it a listen. Well, you know the drill. Or do you?
Thank you, Marty. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on the sunset of Windows 7. The date of the meeting is Thursday, September the 26th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, October the 1st. They begin their meeting at 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace, 158 Main Street, in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center at Ewing has a presentation, Likes, Tweets, and Regrams, an overview of social media. They meet on Tuesday, October the 1st. Meeting time is 2 p.m., and they meet at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Westchester PC User Group has a presentation on online privacy, Thursday, October the 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road at White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on Friday, October the 4th. They start their meeting at 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on genealogy, Thursday, October the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU Silver Building, 32 Waverly Place, room 408, and that's in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meet Friday, October the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Schur Hall at the New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus, out in Old Westbury, New York. We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.